Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in British Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. In Federalist No. 2, John Jay considered the wide-spreading country of the American Republic. It was, he argued, as if the land itself was fashioned by the hand of Providence, which, in a particular manner, blessed it with a variety of soils and productions, and watered it with innumerable streams for the delight and accommodation of its inhabitants. He continued, "A succession of navigable rivers forms a kind of chain round its borders, as if to bind it together." When we think of early American political thought, we tend to overlook the powerful influence of the natural environment on the formation of settlement in both theory and practice. Seminal studies of the ideological origins of the American Revolution approach colonial political ideas as largely derivative from the deep wells of Anglophone ideas, and framed largely in opposition to Britain. Yet, as Jefferson reminded his British audience in the Declaration of Independence, it was important to consider the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. Or, as a writer in the 1620s Virginia explained, colonial law was a product of the nature and novelty of the place. In American States of Nature, Mark Somos recovers a powerful and coherent theme in colonial political thought, a constitutive state of nature that identified the American colonies that would declare independence as a natural community in a state of nature viewed as irreducibly and unexchangeably American. Mark Somos joins me from Heidelberg. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I just want to begin. What is the state of nature?
Well, the state of nature is a term of art in law, theology, political science, and literature. It has been used in many senses, some of them connected and some of them quite distinct. So in the 18th century alone, it described nudity and innocence, or the uncultivated and untamed condition of lands or peoples or animals. Also the kingdom of Satan, i.e. the opposite of the state of grace, and the legal fiction for the pre-political condition of humanity, where people gained and held rights, some or all of which they had to give up and delegate when they combined in a political state. And this last sense has been in continuous use since Thomas Aquinas and William of Ockham in the 13th and 14th centuries, all the way through early modern thinkers such as Hugo Grotius and Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, Samuel Pufendorf, Christian Thomasius, and then to Enlightenment theorists, including Montesquieu, Rousseau, famously Hume and Bataille, and to more recent figures such as Carl Schmitt, Robert Nozick, and John Rawls. And so, while my book focuses on early American uses of this legal fiction, some of the most interesting texts I try to describe connect these distinct meanings. For instance, when revolutionary publicists argued that the American continent was in a state of nature that has so much unique demographic and economic potential, that if the colonists decided to activate their state of nature rights and declared independence from Britain, they would trigger rapid progress and growth, and they would not end up destitute or bankrupt or economically dependent on trade with the old world. It's exactly as you described in your introduction. by connecting distinct established meanings of the state of nature, namely the state of nature as the location and source of rights, with the state of nature as uncultivated and underpopulated territory. Revolutionary theorists invented what I believe is a uniquely American discourse of exceptionalism to show that independence is a promising gambit. Another connection between distinct meanings of the state of nature was made by New England preachers such as Simeon Howard and Nathaniel Whittaker or Gett Hitchcock, who argued that the American colonists' right to collective resistance against British tyranny was justified by the colonists through religion, which united them in a virtuous state of nature under God. I hope this answers the question.
Okay, thank you. So the book traces it about five different sort of permutations, theological places, people, animals, pre-supra political rights, and the what you call the conceptual hinterland of race. So it's everywhere, and those of us who have sort of looked into the pamphlet literature have noticed it. So, I mean, that leads me to the next question, which is, you know, the intellectual history of colonial America has been closely studied, Pulitzer Prize after Pulitzer Prize winning study, the study by Bernard Bailyn that has just turned 50 years old. But what have previous historians, in your view, missed as far as the talk of the state of nature is concerned?
I spent about 10 years hoping that somebody else would write this book, so I wouldn't have to. And I taught legal history courses on human rights and revolutions in the UK and in the US for about 7 years before I decided that I had to write the book. So it's a work of love and frustration. It was clear from the primary sources that the intellectual history of human rights cannot be written or taught without discussing the state of nature in all the thinkers whom I have just mentioned. And then, strangely enough, over the years of teaching, neither I nor the colleagues whom I kept bothering could ever find a secondary source that paid any attention to the hundreds of direct and explicit invocations of the state of nature in American revolutionary texts. So I don't want to pick on writers, but since you mentioned Bailyn, I'd just like to note that it's emblematic of the field that neither brilliant historians such as Bailyn or Gordon Wood or John Philip Reed or William Nelson, nor standard handbooks students turn to, such as the Companion to American Legal History or the Cambridge History of Law in America, discuss the state of nature in American Revolution discourse at all. The primary purpose of my book is to marshal and foreground these hundreds of discussions of the state of nature in the short span of 15 years, from 1761 to 1775. And it's a distant secondary ambition to actually try to make sense of them. So I hope that even if readers disagree with my interpretation, the central role of the state of nature in American revolutionary ideology will no longer be neglected. So the short answer to your question is, what historians have missed is the sheer fact that quantitatively and qualitatively, the state of nature ranks with property and liberty as a fundamental orientational concept. And I believe that no constitutional intellectual history of the American Revolution can be written without it.
So turning to the detail of the book, a major pivot of your argument is a speech of 1761. I wonder if you could just tell us, who gave it? What was it about? And why, for you, is it so significant?
Thank you. So the speech was made by James Otis Jr. in what is now known as Paxton's case. So after George II died, many of these writs of assistance had to be renewed. And 53 Boston merchants engaged Otis to argue against the renewal of these writs of assistance. It's a very famous speech. And in fact, John Adams spent about 60 years from his own 1761 diary entry to a series of letters that he sent to William Tudor, who was writing Otis's biography in 1819, insisting that this speech marked the beginning of the revolution. And I don't think that we have taken Adams seriously enough. But nevertheless, legal historians often describe Otis's speech in Paxton's case as a landmark in the evolution of the American doctrine of judicial review. And since we have lost the speech itself, there has been a great deal of work invested in trying to reconstruct the full text. And in the book, I make two claims about the speech. That its explicit invocations of the state of nature are important and unfortunately neglected, and that I found the best surviving draft. So Adams himself described the speech as, quote, "a dissertation on the rights of man in a state of nature," unquote. And according to Otis, in Adams' summary at least, people had a pre-political state of nature right to life, liberty, property, and complete equality. One inference from the state of nature is that slavery is illegal and completely unacceptable. Adams himself notes in his letter to Otis, that the radical, uncompromising effect of Otis's application of the state of nature to slavery frightened him. And the passage reads, "Young as I was, and ignorant as I was, I shuddered at the doctrine he taught, and I have all my lifetime shuddered and still shudder at the consequences that may be drawn from such premises. Shall we say that the rights of masters and servants clash and can be decided only by force? I adore the idea of gradual abolitions, but who shall decide how fast or how slowly these abolitions shall be made?" That's from Adams's recollection of the speech. Now, Otis's argument is important also for its political impact. It was adopted by the Massachusetts House of Representatives in numerous communications they sent to London. Otis himself further developed his point in a series of works, including The Rights of the British Colonists Asserted and Proved, where Otis celebrated the Glorious Revolution as a complete break in the constitutional continuity that Britain is so proud of. Otis argued that there was a relapse into the state of nature in 1688-89. It was an opportunity to renegotiate everything: the metropolis relationship to the colonies, the slavery, the issue of slavery, naturally, suffrage for women, property qualifications for voting, and the form of government itself. And many of the points Otis made in Paxton's case and in the works that followed up his speech resurface for decades in identical or increasingly revolutionary forms, in colonial messages to London, and in revolutionary American and the radical English press.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like: no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So this speech is enormously significant, and then it comes at the beginning of the decade of the 1760s, where the imperial relationship and the constitutional conventions that govern that relationship sort of break down. And American political writers are gradually reaching around for a series of arguments that justify resistance. And quite a lot of American political thought has to do with security. And you, in the book, you talk about what you term as a turn to self-defense. So what is this turn to self-defense, and why is it decisive in your view to the revolution?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. So I have to admit that the turn to self-defense is part of my interpretation of the hundreds of references to the state of nature in the primary sources. Mm-hmm. So I set out to write the book and describe approximately 2,000 years of state of nature texts. And as the project progressed, I had to reduce that to 15 years. But my actual primary sources I looked at very, very closely and wrote up cover 50 years between 1761 and 1811. Mm. I didn't end up going back to Hesiod, and I didn't describe Thomas Aquinas sufficiently. But nevertheless, I did look very closely at these 50 years. And I think that the discourse falls into four stages. Between 1761 and 1770, the state of nature primarily served as an independent source of rights to support the various grievances and demonstrations and remonstrances that the colonists sent to London. But something changes in 1770, especially with the Abingdon Resolves and the Boston Pamphlet of 1772. From around 1770 to 1775, the sources by and large cluster the inalienable and individual state of nature right to self-defense into a collective right to self-defense that belongs to a natural community of colonists that was abandoned by Britain. From 1775 until 1789, I think the state of nature texts are best understood as part of an intensely contested process of constitution making, both at the federal and the state level. There's absolutely fantastic literature on state-level constitutional debates that features the state of nature very prominently. In the fourth stage, until around 1811, the state of nature is mostly invoked in building a state and building an American self-perception. And at the same time, for the countervailing purpose of reviving the revolution meaning in order to resist centralization and consolidation. So in this stage, I think the state of nature becomes an extremely useful concept to understand how anti-federalists and thinkers like John Calhoun and eventually the Southern states before the Civil War could perceive themselves as true inheritors of the American Revolution. They were invoking this collective state of nature right to self-defense. And so in this four-part scheme, the turn to self-defense refers to these essential texts, such as the Abingdon Resolves, the Boston Pamphlet, and the replies of over 140 towns to Boston by 1773, which I think really has been underappreciated in the secondary literature. It's a fantastic exchange of letters and drafts and arguments. And the exact same stage also includes the First Continental Congress, which spends about one day on administration and housekeeping, and the substantial contributions begin with Patrick Henry declaring that government is dissolved, we are in a state of nature, and he's a Virginian, he's not a Virginian, he's an American. Mm. So there couldn't be more iconic evocations of the term in this particular stage. Mm.
So, you know, broadly speaking, I know you don't want to engage in sort of a historiographical cut and thrust here, and that's entirely reasonable. But I mean, generally speaking, how does the revolution look different when we recenter discussion of the state of nature into its ideological debates? I mean, how does our understanding of it as an event change?
Excellent, thank you. Well, to go back to the introduction, I mean, I think the most important point is that there was such a thing as a distinctive American state of nature discourse. And I think it is distinct for a host of reasons. And I also think it comes back to Europe. I think it has a huge impact in Germany, in the Göttingen School, on Garibaldi, in Latin America, and so on and so forth. So when thinkers involved in these major events involve the state of nature, they often explicitly refer to the American revolutionary sense, not to the not to Rousseau's, not to Locke's, not to Blackstone's, and so on and so forth. So it is an original contribution. And then, secondly, I think that the American state of nature discourse is not reducible to natural rights and natural law. And there are numerous reasons for this view, which I try to describe in the book. First of all, it's not what the texts say. So many texts explicitly distinguish between natural rights and state of nature rights. So for instance, Abraham Williams's 1762 election sermon, or the Observator in the Connecticut Courant, explain that natural rights can be alienated when you join the polity, but state of nature rights are even more fundamental than natural rights, and they are inalienable. They are sort of in the same relationship as fundamental or constitutional laws are to positive law. Yeah. And then I also think it changes our understanding of the American revolutionary ideology, in the sense that that some historians might have overemphasized the influence of Locke. There is no collective right of self-defense grounded in a state of nature in Locke. Mm. The texts themselves invoke Grotius, Hobbes, Pufendorf, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and Battelle explicitly over and over and over and over again. Fantastic archives, such as the archives of Rutgers and Princeton and the University of Philadelphia and Harvard and Dartmouth as well, show that students have been learning from Scottish teachers various exquisite and interesting formulations of the state of nature that have very little to do with Locke. Other historians, I believe, overemphasize the influence of Blackstone. Long before Blackstone's publication in 1765, the commentaries, there already was a sophisticated and effective American state of nature discourse, exemplified by Otis, for instance. So these are four major ways in which I think the historiography of the American Revolution ideology should be slightly amended in light of the primary sources.
I just want to close with one question. Apologies if this is sort of out of the blue, but early on you mentioned American exceptionalism, and this is something that historians, at least, I'm a transplanted North American, but historians in America now, if you use the word exceptionalism or sought its origins, would run in the other direction. I'm just wondering what you mean by that term when you associate it with this particular pattern of political thought.
Excellent, thank you. I mean, it is certainly and indisputably present in the primary sources, but it does mean different things to different people. So someone like William Johnson or Silas Deane would argued that the American Revolution is a sensible and viable proposition because the American content as such is exceptionally powerful. There's a great deal of material and natural potential. So those who believe that a loss of trade with Britain would render dooms the revolution to failure are mistaken. All the colonists need to do is declare independence and kickstart an independent American economy, which will trump Europe's economies in no time at all. And Hamilton leans towards this view as well. Others, for instance, Jefferson, we're not quite optimistic about the collective effort and the economic potential that this collective effort might lead to. But they were extremely optimistic about the exceptional character of the American state of nature when it came to the sheer brute natural power of the continent, minus the economics, if that makes any sense. So you might have seen the excellent books on Jefferson's influence on the conception of American nature that helped him structure the first public museum in Philadelphia, for instance, that led him to argue that all animals are bigger and better in the New World than they are in the Old World, and to counter the so-called degeneracy thesis that was put forth by Buffon and Dapao and Reynal and other European thinkers who adapted Aristotle's view to argue that all things degenerate in the new world. So there was a purely naturalistic view of the American state of nature as well that set up an exceptionalism that was in some ways rival and in some ways complementary to the economic exceptionalism that was equally anchored in a distinct American perception of the American state of nature.
I've been speaking with Mark Somos, the author of American States of Nature, The Origins of Independence, 1761 to 1775, published by Oxford University Press. It is a remarkably detailed work of intellectual history that takes a large body of sources that everybody thought they knew, that everybody had read, that had seen in pamphlet collections and in the footnotes of books that we have mentioned but won't mention again, and has recovered a thick, deep, and revealing discourse of states of nature in all phases of the revolution, writing to and through the revolution. It's a tremendous book. I highly recommend it. Mark, I appreciate you taking the time and for allowing me to speak to you in my language.
Thank you. Thank you very much.